This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
This is Gary Clinton welcoming you to episode 103 of Night Transmission. Do you know the name Ralph Edwards? I think there's a good chance you will, but not as an actor, but rather the creator and sometimes host of game shows. He created Truth and Consequences, This Is Your Life, Name That Tune, and The People's Court. And this episode of Suspense called Ghost Hunt, from June 23rd, 1949, Edwards plays a radio personality named Smiley Smith, who teams up as a radio stunt with a paranormal investigator, a Dr. Reed by name, to investigate a haunted house in Malibu, California. They have with them a wire recorder, and Smith intends to play it back on his show. His whole attitude to this is rather, flippant. His whole attitude to this is rather flippant. He doesn't think anything much is going to happen, even though four of the residents of this house have committed suicide. It's quite good, and without giving you any spoilers, I will advise you that the end's a little bit weak. Maybe you should turn the lights out for this one.
Now, Autolite and its 60,000 dealers and service stations present Suspense. Tonight, Autolite brings you Mr. Ralph Edwards in Ghost Hunt, a suspense play produced and directed by Anton M. Leder. Friends, replace worn-out narrow-gap spark plugs with a set of those new wide-gap Autolite resistor spark plugs. Your motor will idle smoother, give better performance on leaner gas mixtures, actually save gas. These winning benefits are all made possible by a newly developed Autolite 10,000-ohm resistor built right into every Autolite resistor spark plug, making practical a wider spark-gap setting, and that's what does the trick. What's more, Autolite resistor spark plugs with this exclusive Autolite resistor have greatly increased electrode life and cut down on radio and television interference. So, folks, see your Autolite dealer and have him replace old, worn-out, narrow-gap spark plugs with a set of the new Autolite resistor spark plugs. Remember, you're always right with Autolite.
And also remember, the Autolite suspense show is now on television.
Every Tuesday night in many parts of the country.
And now, Autolite presents Ralph Edwards in a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Yeah, didn't that leave you high, huh? Left me feeling treetop tall. That was Louis Armstrong's I Can't Give You Anything But Love. And that's all we have time for on the Hot and Mellow Hour tonight. Yes, this is Smiley Smith, your favorite disc jockey. I hope a whole hoot in the Hot and Mellow Hour home for this evening. I'll be back again tomorrow night, minus the music, but with a little surprise for you. Tomorrow night, Friday night, as you know, is stunt night here at Station WXP, and have I got a stunt for you. Last week, if you remember, I planted my wire recorder in the steam room at a ladies' Turkish bath and let you listen in on the playback, remember? Well, tonight, as soon as I leave the studio, do you know where I'm going? Your friend Smiley is going to spend the night in a haunted house on a spook hunt. You heard me. A spook hunt in a haunted house. I'm bringing my little old wire recorder along with me, and if you tune in tomorrow evening at this time, you'll learn what it's like to spend a night in a haunted house. Ain't that something? A real haunted house. No kidding. Four people are known to have committed suicide there. So tune in tomorrow night and share a real thrill with your old pal Smiley, I must be crazy, Smith. Good night.
Care for a cigar, Mr. Thorpe? I got some cigars in the dash there.
No.
Well, no reason for you to carry a chip on your shoulder, Mr. Thorpe.
Oh, really? Well, I don't like this fool stunt.
Well, I don't see it as a fool stunt at all. I really don't. I think it's the only way you're going to unload this house. Ordinary selling methods won't work in a case like this. Now, don't forget the reputation saddling this house. Four suicides since 1939. You know what people call it. The death trap.
Yes. It's a lot of nonsense.
Sure, but try to convince people of that. Anyway, when this disc jockey offered me this chance to kill all the rumors about the death... about the property, I just naturally jumped and took him up at it. Especially since it don't cost a cent.
You sure about that? I'm not liable for a penny.
Not a cent. We're doing him a favor, letting him use the place, he said. Thanked me for the chance last night when I drove him out here. So one hand washes the other, as the feller says. He got a chance to pull off a stunt, and the wire recording will prove the people the property's A number one, and we increase the chance of selling the place.
Well, as long as it doesn't cost me anything.
Not a thing. He's using his own recorder, and I'm paying for the rental of a couple of walkie-talkies he hooked up to it.
Well, what about this Reed? Does he charge anything?
He comes gratis, too. Dr. Reed is a psychic investigator. Belongs to a couple of societies that do nothing but hunt ghosts. He showed me articles he's written about it in a magazine. Well, here's the house. Yeah, looks real nice in the sunshine, don't it? Yeah, man, smell that sea breeze.
You don't have to sell me. Well, let them know we're here.
Yeah. Probably asleep up all night and everything.
Why don't they come out? You think they've gone?
Well, I told them last night I'd pick them up around 11. Smith! Smith! Hey, Smiley! Dr. Reed! Yeah, fast asleep, I guess. We better go in and wake him up.
Of course, they may have taken the bus back to town.
No. It's a 2-mile hike to the main highway. Smith! Hey, Smiley. Where are you? Wake up.
You don't suppose, do you?
No. Smith? Dr. Reed?
What's that clicking noise from in there?
Well, it's his wire recorder. He left it running. These machines cost a lot of money. Doesn't he care if he uses up his batteries?
Well, where is he? And where's this Reed?
Maybe they're upstairs. Smith? Hey, anybody home?
They must have walked to the highway and taken the bus.
Well, you wouldn't have left these machines.
Well, where are they then? Where are they?
Well, now, don't get excited, Mr. Thorpe.
Don't tell me not to get excited. If something's happened to them in my house, I'm liable.
Well, you try this side. I'll try that.
All right.
Smith? Hey, Smiley? Smith?
Oh. McDonald, come here.
What is... Oh, no.
Reed. Dr. Reed.
No, don't touch him, Mr. Thorpe. You'll get your hands off. Look.
Blood. Is he dead?
I can still feel his pulse. We better get him to a hospital fast. Cigar, Mr. Thorpe?
No, thanks.
Well, why not try to relax? The nurse said Reed would be all right as soon as he's had a blood transfusion.
You told the radio station to be sure and call us as soon as they had any word about Smith?
Yes, I told them. Why don't you sit down?
No, I'm all at sixes and sevens. What do you suppose happened out there last night?
Well, we're going to know in just a second, just as soon as I can get this recorder set up.
You don't suppose Smith and Reed got into a fight, do you?
Yeah, there. Huh? A fight? I don't know.
Well, what's wrong? Won't it work?
Yeah, it works. Take it easy.
1, 2, 3. Testing. 1, 2, 3.
There.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. All set, Dr. Reed? Mr. McDonald? Hey? Okay, here we go.
This is Smiley Smith speaking. Smiley Smith, the ghost hunter. I don't know whether to hope this will turn out to be a success for the sake of the program or a failure for my own sake. Anyway, all the preparations have been made now, and it's up to the spooks. I better tell you where we are. Right now, we're standing on the lawn of a house about 12 miles above Malibu Beach. The ocean is 100 feet away, straight down. The house is perched on a cliff, and there's a sheer drop of about 100 feet right into the old Pacific. Maybe you can hear the surf pounding. I'll turn up the volume. Hear it? Now, I'm going to have you meet two gentlemen who are here with me. Incidentally, we're the only people around for miles and miles. First, I'd like you to meet Dr. Clarence Reed of the British and American Psychical Research Guild. Dr. Reed is a famous investigator of psychic phenomena, and I'm very honored to be associated with him on this ghost hunt. He's smiling in an embarrassed sort of way.
You're much too kind, Mr. Smith.
Dr. Reed has conducted experiments in this field with such great believers in spiritualism as Oliver Lodge and Arthur Conan Doyle. He looks a bit like Santa Claus. He's short, stocky. You don't object, do you, Dr. Reed?
No, indeed.
And he has a magnificent white beard, a truly great beaver. Dr. Reed is so enthusiastic about ghost hunting that he got out of a sick bed this evening to be with us.
Excuse me. My lungs. Mm-hmm. I was gassed in the First World War.
Yeah. Anyway, Dr. Reed and I are here on the lawn looking at the house. Can't see much. It's around, 11 p.m. now. Seems to be a rambling sort of house, two stories high. Since it was built, there have been four suicides here. Is that right?
That's right.
Now, into the mic, please.
Oh, yeah. Four suicides since 1939.
I better tell them who you are so they won't think you're a ghost. Standing with the doc and me is a real estate agent, Mr. Charles McDonald. He handles this property, and he can tell you a lot more about it than I can.
Well, the house was built by a man named Marcus, Toby Marcus, an orange grower. Built the house as a wedding present for his wife. A month after they moved in, she took her own life. On the day of her funeral, he committed suicide the same way. There have been two other cases since then, and
Did they all jump in the ocean?
Yeah, all four of them, right over there. Well. The last one was actually seen doing it, about 3 years ago. He was seen running like all get out the edge of the cliff, and he was shouting and laughing and yelling as though there was people at his side running right along with him.
You kidding?
No, it's a fact. He was laughing and yelling and running, and when he got to the edge, right over there, he jumped and never came above water.
As good an argument against cold baths as ever I've heard.
Since then, people just refuse to live in this house. Silly, I call it. Anyway, if you and Dr. Reed find any sign of a spook, I'll advise the owner to pull the house down and rebuild. But if you don't find anything, I'm hoping this will convince folks that here's a real buy. Yeah, okay, Mr. Smith, you and the doctor are on your own. I'll be by in the morning to pick you up around 11.
Goodbye, Miss McDonald. I hope there's something left for you to pick up in the morning. Well, it's almost pitch black, folks, and I guess Dr. Reed and I ought to begin. I don't believe in ghosts, never have, but what I say is this. If you're dead set on looking for them, this is a dandy place to do it. So long! Mr. McDonald just checked out. And then there were two. Well,
three.
Oh, my dog, yeah. Folks, I have my dog, Jeff, with me. He's a wire-haired terrier, 3 years of age, and he can talk. Yeah, say hello, Jeff. Come on, Jeff, say hello. Come on. Well, anyway, he's a wire-haired terrier, and he's 3 years old. Shall we go inside now, Dr. Reed?
I was about to suggest it.
Now, how do we hunt ghosts, Doctor? How do we do it, huh?
Well, we don't really hunt them. If there should be any in the house, they will come to us.
How cozy.
And please, not ghosts. Do not refer to them as ghosts. We know them as apparitions.
Now, remember, I've no desire to hurt their feelings. Where ghosts are concerned, I say live and let live. Well, we've opened the front door now. Maybe you heard the hinge squeak a little. Now we're standing here looking in. Can't see much. Smells sort of musty and damp. What's the matter, Jeff? What's the matter, boy? Jeff. Oh, come on now, come on. My dog seems to object to entering this house. He has all 4 feet braced, and he's straining against the leash.
Perhaps he senses something we don't.
Like apparitions, maybe?
Perhaps. It's not unusual. Animals lack the veneer of sophistication we humans possess, and are more sensitive to such emanations.
Yeah, come on, Jeff. Now, stop this nonsense. He probably smells a mouse or rat or something. Come on, Jeff. We're going in whether you like it or not. Well, there's a short entrance hall, and over there at the end of it is a flight of stairs leading to the second floor. Jeff! And over here at the left is what seems to be a large reception room. We're entering this large room now. There are windows over there, French windows, and through them I can see the ocean. The electricity hasn't been turned on, so all I have to see by is a flashlight. Not a very powerful one at that.
Dr. Reed is now adjusting his walkie-talkie. It's hooked up to my recorder so that he can cut in while he's hunting and tell us what he's found. Here's a few words from Doc before he sets forth on his investigation through the house.
Ladies and gentlemen... excuse me. Mr. Smith has introduced me as a ghost hunter. He spoke, I think, in a spirit of skepticism and levity. I'd like to assure you all that my purposes here are serious. I have spent my entire life seeking reliable proof of the appearances of apparitions.
Have you ever seen any, ever?
I have seen phenomena which lead me to believe in the possibility of their existence, although I have never seen any. I account myself sensitive to the evidence of their existence. This house, for example, affects me profoundly. It doesn't seem to affect you in the same way.
I'm not too happy about all this, if that's what you mean.
You are not psychic, and therefore not sensitive to these matters as I am. I imagine the question in the minds of those of you listening to us is, shall we find apparitions? I don't know. But I feel they are here, and that they are evil. I sense danger. I shall soon know.
Dr. Reed's leaving the room now to make a tour of the house. First thing I'm going to do is open the windows and let some fresh air in. It feels better already. Cooler anyway. I know that. What was... A bat just flew into the room. I think it's a bat, not a bird. I didn't actually see it, just its shadow as it fanned my face. There it is again. It touched me as it passed.
Jeff, come back here. Jeff, you fool dog, come back here.
Dr. Reed!
For Suspense, Autolite is bringing you Mr. Ralph Edwards in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Hey, Harlow, snap out of it.
Huh? I'm reading a letter about the new wide-gap Autolite resistor spark plugs, Hap.
Oh?
It's from Mrs. Clark Perry right here in Hollywood. She says, our 1948 station wagon has given constant trouble. Finally, the garage man said all the difficulty was spark plugs, and he installed a set of Autolite resistor spark plugs. Now the car runs beautifully. The very first time my husband has been really pleased.
Well, smart garage man.
Smart people to take his advice. Hap, you know, as more and more people learn about wide-gap Autolite resistor spark plugs, and how they make an engine idle smoother, give better performance on leaner gas mixtures, actually save on gas, why, then more people will replace old, worn-out, narrow-gap spark plugs with sensational new wide-gap Autolite resistor spark plugs.
Any more letters like that, Harlow?
Plenty, Hap, plenty. Why, here's another one from New York City.
Read it to me later, Harlow. We haven't time because here's suspense.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage Ralph Edwards as Smiley Smith in Ghost Hunt. A tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Jeff, come back here. Jeff, you fool dog, come back here. Dr. Reed.
Reed speaking. What is it, Smith?
Jeff has run off, my dog. He jumped through the window and ran off.
Oh, so? I told you he sensed something about this house, didn't I?
Yeah, you want to come and see if you can determine what it was exactly that set him off?
Soon. I am making my way slowly up the stairs toward the second floor now. I'm halfway up. I'll be down with you soon.
Folks, my dog's run away. You probably heard him howling. He jumped through the window and took off. Never did anything like that before. Frightened by the bat, I guess. Personally, alone here in this big room, I can understand how he must have felt. This isn't a cheerful spot by any means. I may not be psychic, but I sure have a feeling this house doesn't want us here.
Please again. Excuse me. I have something of great interest to report. I'm now standing in an alcove on the second floor trying to recover my breath. As I reached the head of the stairs, I felt what I think is a definite psychic manifestation. I felt suddenly as though I had been punched in the solar plexus. That's the only way I can describe it. At the same time, I began to perspire. My head is still swimming slightly, and I have difficulty in swallowing. My pulse rate is around 110 in a minute. The sense of evil is very strong. I feel very... what shall I say? Profoundly depressed.
Do you want me up there?
No. I prefer to remain up here alone. The presence of a disbeliever such as you might interfere with my investigation.
Folks, I'd
like you to get a picture of what it's like here. It's very quiet, for one thing. I've never been in such a quiet place. And it's pretty dark. No light except my flashlight. Tell you what, you go now and douse all the lights you have on. Go ahead, put out the lights, and that'll give you a clearer feeling of how it is here with me. Go ahead, put out the lights. Hey, did you hear that? The real estate agent told me I'd probably hear rats and mice in the walls. Well, I can certainly hear them now. Even you can hear them, I think. It's as though...
Dr. Reed speaking. I've been working my way toward the front room, the one directly above the one in which Mr. Smith is now. The vibrations have become stronger and more pronounced as I approach it. I think I'm on the verge of an important discovery.
Important discovery. Did you get that? Now I can hear Dr. Reed moving about in the room above. I don't suppose you can. Have a try anyway, huh? Hear him? I hope he finishes his investigation soon, because, quite frankly, I'd like to get out of here. I can well imagine people becoming unhinged in this place. Right now, I find myself pretty jumpy. Not being very brave, am I? It's being alone in this room down here that does it. This darned old house, the atmosphere, it's so very...
I wish only to make this hurried report before continuing with the investigation in this room. I have carefully sounded out all the parts in this room, and the emanations are most strong from what appears to be a closet, before which I am now standing. As soon as I open the door to this closet, I will have, I think, a thing of great interest to communicate. I find no key to the lock, and so I will attempt to remove the hinges with my penknife, and I will tell you what I find when I open it.
I'll tell you what it would cost to get me to open that door. In the basement at Fort... There's that bat again. It seems to like me the way it keeps... Each time it passes, it touches my face or my neck with its wings. Smelly things, bats. I don't suppose they bathe very often, if at all. I wonder... Get away, you bat! That bat'll be the death of me. That's like a jingle, isn't it? Bat'll be the death of me, the death of me, the death of me. Bat'll be the death of me. It isn't far from London. No, that isn't the way it goes. It's come down to Q in lilac time, in lilac time, in lilac time. Come down to Q in lilac time. It isn't far... For I haven't thought of that since I was a kid in grammar school. Gee, I had a lonely childhood when you come right down to it. I mean, that's my affair, isn't it? Yes, it is. It most certainly is.
I have succeeded in removing the hinges to the door, and I find inside it is not a closet, but much larger. It is, I think, a dressing room. I have not yet been inside, but I am about to enter.
What was I talking about? Bats. Well, the bat flying back and forth in this room. Did you hear that? Did you hear it? Dr. Reed must have knocked something over in the dressing room. A chair, huh? A chair, yeah, a heavy chair by the sound of it. The chair, or whatever it was, must have fallen right over my head. That's the way it sounded. I can see a small stain forming right on the ceiling, right over my head. Something ran across my foot, just a rat, I think it was. I've always hated rats. Most people do, of course. That stain up there bothers me. It's gotten so big so soon. I think I'll take a chance and bother Reed and ask him what it is. Dr. Reed... Reed, can you hear me? Are you all right? Hello? Well, he didn't answer. I think he's just a little bit deaf. Think so. What do you suppose he's found, huh? I'm afraid this is rather dull for you listeners. I'm not finding it so, of course. There. I heard him cough. Did you hear that cough? Hope he's all right. He got out of a sick bed to come here this evening, you know. He was gassed in the First World War, and this place is beginning to get on my nerves a wee bit. Just a teensy-weensy bit.
Reed speaking.
Hello? He switched off. That's the bad cough he's got. I feel so lonely. I've been alone so much in my life. Not so much now, of course, but when I was younger, I was alone so much of the time. You know, struggling to get ahead, living in a hall bedroom, wondering where my next meal is coming from. I get the blues just remembering it. Seems sad, young people having to spend so much time alone. Sad for old people, too, of course. I'm saying of course a lot. Of course I am. Hey, that stain on the ceiling, it's grown amazingly. It's actually beginning to drip. I mean, form bubbles. They'll start dropping soon. Colored bubbles, they seem to be. Odd-shaped stain, like a body lying on its back with its arm stretched out. It's cheerful. Oh. I'll certainly advise Mr. McDonald to have this place pulled down. I'll go upstairs in a minute or two to see how Dr. Reed's making out. You know, listeners, I really believe I'd go completely crazy if I had to stay here much longer. Wears you down. That's exactly what it does. It wears you down. It's so close and musty in here. I feel sort of trapped. Don't know why I said that. That's what they call this place, you know, the death trap. There, what did I tell you? That stain started to drip drops. Drip drops. Drip drops. Drip drops. I'll catch the next one with my hand. Reed! Dr. Reed! I'm going upstairs now, listeners. I'm afraid something has happened to Dr. Reed. I'm not kidding now. I mean, this is on the level. Which room could it be now? Right? Left? No, right. This is it, I think. Well, evening, gentlemen. And madam, I'm so glad to see you. I was just aching to see somebody. Anybody. I've been so lonely down there. What have you done with the doctor, huh? I know he's been hurt. See the color of the bubble on my hand? What have you done with him? Make way, please, gentlemen. Make way.
Well, this isn't the funniest darn thing. This can't be Dr. Reed lying here. He didn't have a red beard. Now, don't crowd me, gentlemen. Don't crowd me, please. Huh? You want me to go where with you? You want me to do what? Speak up, gentlemen. To the cliffs. Down to the cliffs? You mean right now? Well, all right, if you'll come with me. I don't want to be alone anymore. You will come with me? All of you? All four of you? You too, ma'am? Oh, good. Come on, then. To the cliffs! To the cliffs! To the cliffs! To the...
He jumped over the cliff. He jumped over the cliff. McDonald, he jumped over...
Mr. McDonald, Mr. Thorpe, you may come in to see Dr. Reed now.
What? Uh-huh.
Dr. Reed is conscious. You may see him now.
Is he able to talk?
Just for a few minutes. In here.
Come in. Come in, gentlemen.
How are you, Dr. Reed?
We've been waiting to see you.
Yes, and I must apologize, gentlemen. I had a most unfortunate accident. Hemorrhage.
Hemorrhage?
Yes. My lungs, you know. Now, gentlemen.
Hemorrhage? Dr. Reed, what happened in that house? What happened to Smith? We've just been listening to a playback of the recordings you made out there.
Smith? Well, isn't he with you?
We've just heard the recording, Dr. Reed. Smith jumped over the cliff. Into the ocean.
Oh, that poor boy.
Dr. Reed, will you please tell us what happened? From what we heard on the recording, there were ghosts in that house.
Ghosts? I didn't see any ghosts.
But Smith, what about him?
If he went over the cliff, it was fear that drove him over.
But
gentlemen, I didn't see any ghosts. As for that unfortunate young man, who can say now what he saw or thought he saw?
Play was adapted for radio by Walter Newman from an original story by H.R. Wakefield, with music composed by Lucian Morawek and conducted by Lud Bluskin. The entire production was under the direction of Andrew M. Leader.
I hate that. I hate it every time they do that. I mean, here you have a perfectly good story, one that has built suspense nicely, and for some reason at the end of the show, they pull a Scooby-Doo. None of it was real. Why couldn't it have been real? I mean, it's a story. You don't have to believe in ghosts to enjoy a ghost story. For example, I don't believe in ghosts. Oh, I used to. Well, I used to believe in something. I've had a couple of odd experiences. In this restaurant that's set on Highway 101, about halfway between Madron, California, where I grew up, and Morgan Hill, California. Where, when I was about 17, I worked in a couple of different capacities. First as a janitor, and then later as a dishwasher. And during my time there, I certainly saw things that I cannot today explain. And at the time, was inclined to believe that it was something to do with the spirit world. These days, of course, because I can't explain something, because something scared the hell out of me, I realize that this is not proof of the paranormal. Just proof of a spooky place. I still don't know what to make of it.
Autolite resistor spark plugs are ignition engineered by Autolite, which makes more than 400 products for cars, trucks, airplanes, and boats in 28 plants from coast to coast. Autolite also makes complete electrical systems for many makes of America's finest cars. All ignition engineered to fit together perfectly, work together perfectly, because they're a perfect team. The lifeline of your car. So, folks, don't accept electrical parts that are supposed to be as good. Remember, you're right with Autolite.
Up next is a show that I'm kind of fond of. It's a South African suspense and a horror program produced by Michael McCabe and aired by the South African Broadcasting Corporation's Springbok service, Beyond Midnight. With its quite natural and easy descent into madness, murder, and the supernatural, it found a place in my heart and quite a number of other old-time radio devotees. It doesn't seem to have had a regular host. Now, some of the shows did have a framing narration. Others just started up. It might be that there was a host for all of these shows that did an opening, but somehow, in the passage of time, those framing narrations have been lost in some of the recordings. Or maybe there was a script that was supposed to be read live by the announcer. It's just one of those mysteries of old-time radio, and there are no shortage of those. There are 71 known episodes, most of which have survived, and the program ran between November the 1st of 1968 and May the 24th of 1971. I don't know when this particular episode, The Yellow Dressing Gown, ran. It's a story about Lillian Hamilton, her completely faithless husband, Jason, and his mistress. Oh, and Lillian's devastating guilt over the illness of her daughter Henrietta, and a truly shattering betrayal.
Lillian Hamilton sat at the writing table in her bedroom. She turned her head and looked out of the window at the garden in which she spent a lot of her time. The roses were blazing in the two long beds. Lillian Hamilton sat at the writing table and slowly, in a style that was not good, but colorful and evocative, penned the story of her married life in a thick school exercise book. The last chapter was not going to be written, of course, for the final chapter of any autobiography must remain unwritten. Poor Lillian.
Poor Lillian. Oh, dear. You must mow the lawn. So much work to do. Delphiniums, campanula, regale lilies, Canterbury bells. All dead now. Must remove their little dried-up heads. The roses are like
neon lights. Never seen roses so bright like neon lights.
Jason. He was her husband. His favorite color was blue. And on their honeymoon, she had worn blue to please him. But blue had never suited her. And so she had stopped wearing blue. Greens and burnt oranges suited her best. Yellow, too. She looked good in yellow. She looked especially good in her yellow dressing gown. When a story is unfolded through the pages of a book, we can cheat if we wish. We can look at the last page, the last line. We can prepare ourselves for shock, if there is one. When a story is heard, though, this is impossible. Not even Lillian Hamilton could look ahead to the last chapter. We, too, shall have to wait a while before we learn the last chapter's secret. But it is permitted to glance at the pages which tell of the present and the immediate past.
Blue was always his favorite color. Blue, of course, is for Carola Haig Dunfield, his mistress. Blue sets off her beauty to perfection. I never thought I'd have a husband with a mistress. Strange. A husband with a mistress called Carola. A husband who buys a cottage in the country. For me.
Very beautiful. There are roses galore. You know how you like roses. It's not far from Pangbourne, and within easy reach of London. I'll tell you what we'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, we leave Henrietta behind in Cheney Gardens at weekends. Nurse Mooney can have her.
Why?
Why?
Yes, why do we have to leave Henrietta behind?
Darling, you need time off from the child. You need a change of scene as well. Nurse Mooney can take her own 2 half-days off during the week. She can have sole charge of Henrietta at weekends. You'll have a rest, and Henrietta will appreciate you all the more for not seeing you so often. Don't think you're Victorian, but I'm all for children not seeing too much of their parents.
Jason, it's a lovely idea, having the cottage and that, and I'm sure it is lovely if you say so.
That's really. At weekends, you'll be able to do your writing. You'll have complete peace and quiet. My darling, you should always wear green. Remember how you used to try to wear blue? It never suited you.
Once upon a time, Carola was a friend of mine. I even introduced her to Jason. So long ago, it might have been part of another incarnation. In fact, it was only 4 years ago. And now, she is his mistress. He doesn't even think that I know. She knows, though. She knows how aware I am of the situation. But there'll never be any scenes. I shan't allow Jason ever to think that it gives me pain. That would only make him choose between us and give her great satisfaction. Carola. Nah. Oh, how I hate the way she puts everything into its diminutive.
Henny, so lucky to have such a beautifully secure childhood. I mean, despite her illness. I mean, it must be so nice to have such secure parents. My childhood was positively penniless, absolutely nomadic. And Rue is so good to her. But you know...
You mean Nurse Rooney, don't you, Carola?
I thought... Pardon? Oh, yes, that's what I said. Rue is so good to her. She's like a mother. I was going to say I met Jim the other day. Oh, and please don't call me Carola, my dear. I do hate it. La is so much friendlier. Anyway, I met Jim the other day, and a jovial witch. You mean? You're determined to take the long way round, dear, aren't you? Anyway, Jim has become a complete bohemian. She's no sense of responsibility at all.
Hello, you too.
Hello, Jay, darling. I was just telling Lily about Jim. Oh, isn't Lily funny, Jay? So serious. Anyway, would you believe it? Jim's working in that same dreadful little art gallery I was in. The one in Knightsbridge. Oh, you must remember, Jay, darling.
There are many women, I suppose, who would never understand why I don't confront Jason. Why I don't tell him that I know Carola is more than just a family friend. But I shan't tell him that I know. I'm too frightened of what would happen. And at least this way, he is mine. Even if I have to share him occasionally. He was always faithful to me before Carola. I think. Yes, I know he was. It's hard to think she took him away while Henrietta was ill. I suppose she has no real feelings at all. To take a woman's husband away during the sickness of their only child would only have added spice to the affair as far as she was concerned. But poor, poor Henrietta.
And Lillian looked out again at the roses and the dried heads of the Canterbury bells, and tears of sadness came into her eyes as she thought of Henrietta. The child had been 10 when polio had struck, and it had left her paralyzed in her arms and her right leg. It had happened when they had gone as a quartet on holiday to the west of Ireland. Lillian had thought that the little girl had been suffering from flu, and a lot of precious time had been wasted before a doctor had been summoned from Limerick.
It was my fault. Always my fault. I was stupid. I shall never have another breakdown, though. I shall remain strong from now on. I shall put up with this piracy, no matter how many times Jason mysteriously finds that he's got to be away on working weekends. I shall never admit that I knew. I won't give her that satisfaction. And I've got Henrietta. There was a time when I felt that it would be easy for me to kill La. Oh, yes. I believe I could have killed her quite easily. Especially the day when she first let me know about her and Jason. And she did it so cleverly, without saying a word. Just by her silences when I talked about him.
Of course I'm fortunate. I don't think I didn't realize that. I have a clever husband. And it's awful to say this, but when his mother dies, he'll be even richer. Little Henrietta will be an heiress.
You're so loyal to Jay, darling. He appreciates it so much.
Does he? Yes. You know he does. Don't you? Yes, he appreciates me. I love him very much. And if he ever left me, I don't think I could go on living. Cat! Oh, my cat, darling! Oh, cat! Oh, you know, dear, I'm afraid Cat has become perfectly attached to me since your holiday in Yugoslavia. He let me do anything with him. Don't you, Boofus? Don't you, love? Oh, Cat, say hello to Lillian. I'm not your owner. You're a bad boy. Oh, Lillian, say walkies.
Cat, come on. Come on, boy. Come on.
Oh, Cat, there's a mouth. Go on, tell him. R and Doug's insulting. He didn't even say hello to you. Oh, darling, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to steal your doggy from you.
They're fickle animals.
Yes, they are. Aren't they?
Poor Cat. He doesn't know he's only a dog. Perhaps Miss Haig Dunfield's mission in life is to steal things. Husbands, dogs. And Jason treats me well, really. Even when he invites her to Cheney Gardens, he still goes through the rigmarole of inviting another man so that the numbers are even. She made up her mind to marry him, I know that. But she believes she's got all the time in the world. She reckons that if Jason can persuade me that his happiness lies in his freedom, I'll give him a divorce. But I know La far better than Jason knows her. In the drama of her life, she has reached the end of Act One. Now, she wants a man of her own. She wants permanent security now. Well, she's got to be attracted to him as well, of course, and after all, she ought to know by now what kind of man attracts her. Her experience must be, bossed. Only I can't write down any of this. Poor Jay thinks I'm writing short stories. 5 o'clock. Jason should be here by 7:30 at the latest. Cold supper. Vichyssoise, salmon, and strawberries and cream. Please don't phone Jason and say you can't come till tomorrow. Oh, please don't. I've got everything ready. I couldn't bear it. I know. I'll go and tidy up the border. It's lovely in the garden at this time of day.
And she began the usual hunt for her secateurs. They weren't in the garden shed, and so she came back into the house and began pulling out drawers and opening cupboards. She discovered several bills that needed her attention, but no secateurs. Electricity, water rates, garage. And then, she found the crystal ball. I say found. She knew it was there, of course. She used to believe she could tell fortunes by it. Smiling nostalgically, she brought it up to her face, almost caressing its cold, spherical surface. Crystal ball. And if Corolla Haig Dunfield, what an unattractive name, had come to the end of Act One of her life, then so had Lillian Hamilton, as she sat quietly by the writing desk and gazed deep into the crystal. It lay amidst a cluster of bulb catalogues from Diaga and the bills. It lay hard and cold and forgotten. And smiling nostalgically, she took up the crystal ball with which she had once told fortunes.
I'd forgotten all about you. He'd be so angry, Jason would, seeing me hold this again. My psychic powers were always very modest, so... Oh, Jason... You were born with a dislike for all soothsayers and seers. Nothing. It looks dead, empty. I used to see things. I did, really, no matter what Jason may think. I used to see things. Good things. Bad things, too.
minutes went by, and while she concentrated, the interior of the globe clouded, and then gradually cleared, like morning mist dissolving under the onset of the sun. She was peering into a room, papered in stripes of lime and lemon. A bed was pushed up against a wall.
It's the ground floor room in Cheney Gardens. There's Henrietta lying on the bed. I can see her in the crystal. Oh, if only I could show you, Jason. You'd have to believe you'd... Oh, someone's come into the room.
And clearly, in the crystal, Lillian saw a door open and a figure enter the room. The figure was a woman, and the woman was wearing a yellow dressing gown.
When was this? I only bought that dressing gown yesterday. I bought it at Harrod's. This is the future. It hasn't happened yet. It isn't new anymore. It's faded with washing. It's old now, the dressing gown.
She's asleep. Henrietta's asleep, Jason.
What am I doing? What am I doing?
And Lillian Hamilton watched herself in the future, in the crystal, take a pillow from beside the sleeping child's head and press it over its head and press and press and press.
I was smothering her. I was killing my baby. But don't shoot. Jason's right. It's rubbish, nonsense, because if it was true, how could I go mad, insane, be the murderer of my baby? Life couldn't be so terrible. It couldn't. Oh, Jason, must be dead.
Lillian?
Yes?
You took so long to answer, I thought you must be out. Look, I can't get down tonight. In fact, I doubt very much whether I can manage tomorrow either. I'll be with you for lunch on Sunday, and we can drive back together after tea. I'll come by train. I've a date with a fellow from Barringer's in New York. He should have been here today, but he couldn't make it. Got tied up in Paris. You know what these tycoons are like. Only time he'll be able to give me is tomorrow evening. Sorry to change plans at the last moment. There it is. It might lead to a big deal, you see. Look after yourself. Lillian.
Yes, Jason, I quite understand.
Is anything wrong?
No, Jason, nothing. I'm just disappointed.
Well, goodbye, old girl.
Goodbye. I'd like to be imprisoned in this garden forever. In a timeless and beautiful July. I'd never have to see another human being. Never. Not this Rooney. Not Jason. Not Henrietta. Especially not... Oh, the first time. The very first time now, I think I hate her. He's only 90 minutes away. He could come here, even though he's got a business dinner. He could still come here. He's free tonight and most of tomorrow. So... I'm sure. It's La. Jason. I need you. I need to tell you what I see. You've got to help me. You've got to help me not to kill my little girl. We should get back to Cheney Gardens before Sunday. You might stop off to say goodnight to Henrietta. You might even read to her for a little while. Maybe he was at the flat when he telephoned. Maybe she was there too. Oh, Jason, I'm going to be a murderess. I... Canterbury Bells? Oh, Dick. I'm going to go mad. I'm going to kill the one little tiny thing I love most in the world. Oh, one of us has to die. It must be me. It must be me. Must be me. Jason adores her. He'll look after her. He'll take care of her. If I do it, it won't matter. I'll be safe in Henrietta. I'll open the way for Jason and La, but it doesn't matter. Jason won't suffer. La will make him see that it isn't his fault.
She's so persuasive. So assured.
Poor Lillian. Oh, Jay, darling, I'm not to blame her. No. She was always unstable, darling. Not afraid, though. I understand. In a way, she acted very courageously. It's all over now. You must think about yourself. Me. No notice there. No explanations. I'll lock the door. When Mrs. Roberts comes in the morning, she won't be shocked. She'll know something's wrong and won't be too upset. She'll give her help and it won't be hard to die.
Then she went and got a bottle of whiskey from the cupboard and a little box of white pills and climbed the stairs to her bedroom, passing on her way the theatrical prints, the Victoriana she and Jason had discovered on a barrow in the Portobello Road when they were putting the finishing touches to the cottage together.
Dear Crystal Ball, it's you I have to thank. You saved my little girl's life. You showed me what I must do. Thank you.
In a recess of the bureau, above the line of drawers, there was a photograph of herself and Jason, taken on their wedding day.
How young I was. Jason, so handsome. Funny little pages. Funny little bridesmaids. That one's got no front teeth. Mark Thornton and Jenny Fenley. I can't remember the names of the others. Can't remember. Thank you, my darling.
Just.
Happy.
Of course.
Can I have another one of those, please, Jay?
Certainly. They're quite free, and they come in all sizes.
Like that. Lovely.
And in the cottage, in the country, in a bedroom, above the garden where the Canterbury bells had faded and turned brown and brittle, stood a half-empty whiskey bottle on a table beside a bed. Near it, a box that had once contained pills. On the floor lay a strange crystal ball. On the bed lay a woman, a once beautiful woman, even now very attractive. Her hair was auburn, and her eyes were brown.
Where's the crystal? Where is it? Oh, there it is. What are you down there?
And cupping her hands around the smooth glass sides of the crystal, she gazed into its depths. It was difficult to concentrate. She wanted so much to sleep. Sleep. A fast, hard 90-minute drive away, Jason Hamerton sat with...
Oh, Jay, you are an oak. What did you do then? Jay, where are you going?
Oh, I must go and see him, yes.
Don't leave me.
I must just read him a story, darling, and then... Well, what's the matter?
Matter?
You look cross.
Must you read her a story tonight?
Oh, I promise.
Sometimes I believe you care more for her than you do for me.
She's my daughter. My poor little crippled child.
Oh, yes. Well, we all know who's to blame for that.
That's enough. That's dead and gone. From the past.
I love you. I can give you more than anyone else in the world.
I know.
No. Never forget that.
I won't. Just 5 minutes. A short story, Laura. Just a little one.
Very little cripple. How I loathe and detest her child. Dear little Henrietta, I can see you, my sweetheart. My poor, poor darling.
But this time she forced herself to watch for longer, and the scene in the crystal ball continued. Lillian sat horror-stricken as she watched herself rise from smothering her child and throw the pillow aside. She forced herself to accept the role of spectator, to be present at the culmination of a murder which now would never occur. She saw the yellow dressing gown, old, frayed. She saw the mane of hair cascading down across the shoulders of the gown. She saw the hair tossed aside. But the hair was black.
You are funny, Lillian. Why must you always get things wrong? You're so utterly pathetic. I can almost feel sorry for you.
Through waves of infinite fatigue, Lillian saw the woman in the picture, in the crystal, rise from the bed. The scene in the crystal had a flawless clarity, and she was helpless to withdraw her gaze. As she got to her feet, the woman in the crystal turned her head on its lovely neck and looked straight in her direction, and the beautiful azure blue eyes were bright with malice and mockery. Lillian was incapable of rousing herself. She was sinking fast into the quicksands of inertia. The woman in the yellow dressing gown was La.
There are strange tales of violent death visited upon those who violated the sanctity of King Tut's last resting place. But most curious of all of these, and best authenticated, is the remarkable tale of the Naked Man of Newbury, the most baffling of all the stories surrounding the opening of King Tut's tomb.
It was on the 16th of February, 1923, that the sepulchral tomb of King Tut was opened. And it was just 1 month and 1 day later that the strange event occurred at Lord Carnarvon's ancestral estate near Newbury in Hampshire. On the morning of that day, two of his lordship's retainers sat in the sunroom of his palatial home. They were discussing his exploits in far-off Egypt.
But it ain't right, Fenton, opening the graves of people what's dead. And them what does it'll suffer for. Why, I... Oh! Oh, dear. Standing on the desk.
God, blimey. He looks like a wild man.
And what's he doing running around stark naked?
It was quite inconceivable. And yet there he was, a weird, grotesque figure of a man, his hair flying, his face distorted by a maniacal grin, and not a stitch of clothes on his body. In an instant, he was gone. A message arrived at the Carnarvon home, a message that served only to deepen the mystery.
He's sick. Says he's down there in Egypt with some kind of a strange malady. It was bound to happen, what was breaking into the grave of a man what's dead. He took to his bed on the 17th of March.
Well, now, that's strange. That's the same day we first seen the wild man.
Reports of the progress of his lordship's illness arrived regularly at Newbury. And meanwhile, on the Carnarvon estate, the wild man continued to be seen. There came a day when Fenton, seeing the curious figure wandering across the meadow behind the barns, decided to solve the mystery once and for all. He pursued him through the woods.
Huh. Oh, blimey. And now he's gone into the woods. And he waved to me. Just like he was saying goodbye.
From that moment on, there were no further reports of the disreputable and indecent savage who had haunted Lord Carnarvon's lands in Newbury. He vanished as suddenly as he had come. As for his lordship himself, there was one last message from those who tended him in Cairo.
Lord Carnarvon is dead. He passed away peacefully at 3 o'clock on the afternoon of the 5th of April.
There's something very strange about all this, Mrs. Hawkins. The last time I seen the wild man, the last time anybody seen him, it would have been 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Cairo on the 5th of April.
There is no one who has dared to say with assurance that a connection exists between the death of Lord Carnarvon and the Naked Man of Newbury. nor has anyone offered evidence to prove that either event bears a relation to the opening of the tomb of Tutankhamun, Pharaoh of Egypt. And yet it is difficult to evade certain disturbing and tantalizing conclusions in view of the facts. Facts incredible, but true.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon. I mentioned X debuted on April the 8th of 1950 and would run until September of 1951. And although it wasn't the first science fiction anthology series on radio, that distinction belongs to another short-lived series called 2000 Plus, which I occasionally play here. It was, however, the first to use published stories from established science fiction authors, and made a practice of adapting the works of such authors as Mary Linster, Ray Bradbury, William Penn, Robert Heinlein, many others. Now that I've sung the praises of Dimension X, it was far from perfect. This July 21st, 1950 episode, Beyond Infinity, is an example of this program at its worst. Instead of adapting the work of a well-known science fiction writer from a previously published story, they would occasionally resort to the use of a staff writer. Most of the time, these staff writers were obviously people who knew very little about the traditions of science fiction, and very little about the current state of nuclear physics, especially in this story, which at its center requires the acceptance of what was even then a pretty well outmoded view of the structure of the atom. By the time this program was written and produced, it was well enough established that the Rutherford Bohr model of the atom, which had a very superficial resemblance to a star with planets circling around it, was not entirely correct. So we have a story here in which, in a totalitarian nation, rebels plot to use a unique weapon that shrinks objects to microscopic size. You know what happens when they try it on people. As I say, the science in this episode is particularly poor, and the writing ain't great. The main reason I'm presenting it here is it is an interesting historical document.
Wheaties presents Dimension X.
Adventures in time and space. Transcribed in future tense.
Dimension X.
On stage tonight, Dimension X, another in the Wheaties big parade of exciting half-hour presentations.
Now, tonight's adventure into the unknown. Into the world of Dimension X. Somewhere in Europe, a man is walking through the darkness down a cobblestone street. It's early evening still, only a little past eight. But the street is strangely deserted. He pauses, looks behind him, then knocks quietly on a door.
Yes?
Is Engineer Wensler in?
What is it, please?
Mrs. Wensler?
Yes.
I'm selling brushes. We have a nice line of brooms. They sweep well.
Do they sweep the little or the large?
Both. They're especially fine for the large.
Come in. What cell are you in?
I'm not with the Underground. I'm an American, newspaper correspondent. It's all right. Chief Nine said I should see your husband. He gave me the password. Look, you know the Americans are on your side.
Well, I don't know. My husband is not home at the moment. If I...
Ava, who is it?
Someone to see Alan, Father.
Oh.
My father-in-law knows nothing. Don't say anything which might disturb him.
Okay.
You wish to see my son, Mr...
Arnold. Yes, a friend asked me to look him up.
Mr. Arnold is an American correspondent, Father.
Oh, an American. It is not often I have had the chance to talk to an American these days.
Things have changed, haven't they?
Yes, these last few years, we have been out of touch with the world. I was working in my laboratory, Mr. Arnold. Would you care to come in while you wait for my son?
Father... Not the laboratory.
Oh, Ava, we cannot ask our guest to sit alone in the library. And besides, I would like to talk. Huh? This way, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Arnold, I know nothing of politics. My only interest is science. Come, I will show you what we are doing. A most interesting experiment. Really very interesting.
Oh,
Dr. Lenz now. Oh, this is Dr. Erickson, my associate. Dr. Erickson, Mr. Arnold.
An American.
Yes.
Dr. Lenz, is it advisable to allow strangers in the laboratory?
Oh, Mr. Arnold, it's my son's friend.
Dr. Lenz, you will recall that the last directive...
It has no bearing on the work we are doing. Our experiment is in the field of pure science. It has no military application.
But the directive said...
Dr. Erickson, may I remind you that I am still in charge of this laboratory.
Very well. If you will excuse me, I want to test a new diatomic
catheter. I will do that.
Sorry, Dr. Wensler. I'm afraid your friend Erickson doesn't like my looks.
Oh, no. It's not that. It's just that he's worried. He's worried for me. Afraid that someone will misinterpret your visit and report me to the authorities. He's my most loyal and trusted assistant. But he tends to exaggerate the danger.
Well, I hope you're right, Doctor. Say, this is some setup you've got here. That 10-foot plastic cylinder, what's that for?
Every experiment must have a focal point, and that transparent cylinder is ours.
Mm-hmm.
The objects upon which we wish to work are placed inside and brought under the catalyzed beam over here.
Ava!
That's Alan now. Excuse me, I go and tell him.
What is this experiment you're working on, Dr. Wensler?
A very interesting new problem. You say you are not a physicist or engineer, Mr. Arnold?
No, I'm not, but I can follow you, if that's what you mean.
Yes. Well, you have been working with the problem of subatomic particles. Now, in attempting to manipulate them, to bring them closer to each other, we have discovered that we can shrink objects, reduce them in size...
Well, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. How much can you reduce them? Half size?
Oh, much more. It can make objects become microscopic and still retain their characteristics.
Doesn't seem possible.
It can make them even smaller. Much smaller. Theoretically, in fact, down to atomic dimensions.
Well, as I said before, I'm no expert, Dr. Wensler, but tell me, what's the point? What good does it do to shrink anything down to that size?
You do not understand. Man has never actually seen an atom. But if we can reduce a camera and recording instruments to the atom size, then we would know the secrets of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, there you are, Mr. Arnold.
Oh, yeah. Hello, Alan.
You can't be interested in this. Why don't we go into the study and talk?
But Mr. Arnold is interested.
Well, sir, maybe I'd better talk to Alan at that.
Excuse me, Dr. Wensler.
Yeah.
I mean to ask you if you think you can get along without me for a few minutes. There's something I must do. It's important.
Yes. As long as it will not take too much time.
No, it won't take me long. It has been a pleasure, Mr. Arnold. I shall see you soon, I hope.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Alan, let's go talk.
¶¶
Your credentials seem to be in order, Mr. Arnold. I talked to our chief after Ava explained why you were here. I don't agree with him.
Alan, you think the chief of your cell would have let me come here if he didn't think I was trustworthy and could help?
I know, but...
Public opinion can't be marshaled overnight, you know. Not even in America. Suppose the revolution is successful.
It will be.
All right. Your only chance to make it stick will be in recognition by our government. And immediate help. Now, my stories can do a lot to lay the foundation for that. And with the date of the uprising so near...
You know too much, Mr. Arnold, if this should leak to the secret police.
Now, don't worry about it. It's my neck as much as yours.
Hmm. What do you think, Ava?
Chief Nine said he was to be given the fullest cooperation.
Very well, then. What do you want to know?
Question one. What makes you think this revolution really has a chance? You can't fight tanks and guns with just your bare hands.
Mr. Arnold, we believe the Wensler machine can solve our biggest problem.
What's that?
How to collect arms without being attacked by the secret police.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see.
Now, suppose we could reduce all our equipment. Electronic guns, ray gas, anti-tank blaster. Anything which could be brought in unassembled. Reduce it to so small a size that a woman's handbag could hold enough to equip a regiment. You see what that would mean?
Yeah, sure. No one would think of looking for a cannon.
Precisely. But Father's machine and the cylinder were necessary for the reduction. That's why our supply depot is right here.
Here?
Yes. When the day arrives, we'll enlarge the arms and pass them out.
Yes, but where's the stuff now?
Ava.
Yeah.
Please get me that model from the mantel.
Oh, of course. Here you are.
Take a look at this, Mr. Arnold.
Well, that's a model of an anti-tank blaster, complete to every detail.
Not a model, Mr. Arnold. This is an anti-tank gun. Reduced in the cylinder by the Wensler process. At the proper time, we shall enlarge it, wheel it out through the garage, and set it up. When the men assemble, we pass out the rest of the arms, and we have our revolution. A division of men, properly armed, can take the city.
Let's get back to the laboratory. Father will think it odd that we have been gone so long.
Oh, I was wondering where you were, Alan. I don't know what's keeping Erickson. He should have been back long ago. I need some help on this circuit.
Of course, Father. What are you doing?
Erickson, I have amplified the effect by putting another diatomic catalyzer into phase. I want to give a test run, Alan, if you will bring one of the animals from the cage.
Yes, Father.
Animals?
Yes, we are experimenting over the reduction of living animals, guinea pigs.
How does it work?
Those we diminish to microscopic size return unharmed. But those sent down to the atomic dimension...
Yeah?
The cylinder returns. But there's nothing inside. Nothing.
Well, Dr. Wensler, have you ever tried it on a human being?
I tried to persuade Father to send me down to find out what's making the animals vanish.
No, Alan.
But, Father, we've installed high-frequency radio communication now. If anything started to go wrong with me, I could tell you in time to reverse the process.
No, I will never permit it.
All right. Guinea pigs it is, then. But someday, Father, I... Yes, dear?
Come to the window.
What is it?
That man, the one in the raincoat. He has been standing in that doorway across the street ever since I looked out the window.
What of it?
I don't like it, Alan. He has been standing there just looking at our house.
Oh?
Alan, do you think it is?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Ava?
Yes?
You know what we planned in this eventuality.
Yes.
Get the arms and the provisions. We can't afford to take a chance.
All right, Alan.
Now, what is it, my son? What is...
Father... It's better for you not to know too much, but I'm a member of the underground.
No.
Ava, too. We have... No. Well, we have some contraband hidden in the house. We'll have to put it in the cylinder.
Contraband? What do you mean?
Arms, Father. Arms and provisions for an army reduced to 140 its size.
Alan!
Yes, we must put them in the cylinder and warm up the machine. If it is the secret police, we'll make the arms invisible, microscopic in size.
Can I help?
If you wish, Mr. Arnold, you can help my wife get the supplies.
Okay.
What is it, Ava?
Two police cars are just on the corner. They're full of men.
That changes matters. Father, you'll have to operate the machine yourself. Ava and I are getting into the cylinder.
No, Alan, you can't. It's too dangerous.
It's the only way, Father. Those are the secret police. Diatomic catalyzer ready?
Ready.
set at 0.034.
Good. All right, Ava. Get in the cylinder.
Alan, I can't let you take the chance, Alan. Isn't it enough to make the supplies disappear?
Not for the secret police. They must know something, otherwise they wouldn't be here.
But how could they prove anything?
No, Father. Every man has his breaking point. And I can't afford to gamble with the lives of others. I don't know how I'd react on the torture.
Torture?
Oh, Father, you are naive. But don't worry, you'll be safe. Everyone knows you aren't interested in politics. Mr. Arnold is an American. Perhaps that will protect him.
They're coming now.
Oh, my son, what have you done?
There's no time for recriminations now, Father. I'm getting in with Ava. Arnold, will you help my father with the machine and after?
Yes, I'll do whatever I can.
Thank you. Now, take us down to sub-microscopic size.
Yes.
Hold us down until the police have gone. Tell them we've left. They won't dare meddle with the machine. Tell them it will mean death to anyone who gets in the way of the beam. When they're gone, bring us back up. I'll maintain radio silence until I hear from you.
Very well, my son.
There they are. The machine's warmed up. Move over, Ava. I'm coming in.
Let me... Lassie.
I've switched on the radio. If you can hear me, secure the porthole, Arnold.
Okay, we hear you. Porthole secure.
Ready, Father?
Yes. Are the oxygen then tanks all right?
Ava? Yes.
They're breaking down the door.
Atomic setting, 034. Preliminary release. Temperature?
27 degrees centigrade. 760 millimeters pressure. Hurry, Father.
Very well. Now. Break on.
Alpha 4. Beta 16. Gamma 0.12. Temperature 30 centigrade. Pressure 1100.
Be careful.
Holy mackerel, the cylinder's only 3 feet high. Open that
door. Temperature 36. Pressure 1800.
It's getting too high. I can't do it. Stand by to reverse.
No. The temperature and pressure show signs of stabilizing. Now 38 and 2,000. Make setting at angstrom 5, 10 times to the third.
That's a small.
We can't afford to take chances.
Only 3 inches high.
It's all right, Father. Temperature and pressure beginning to drop.
Thank God.
A half inch high.
Oh, they're coming. They're coming.
Goodbye, Father. God bless you.
Son.
If anything happens, it isn't your fault. Remember, this is my doing. Ava, switch off.
Yes,
come on.
Stop. Come on. Don't come near the beam. No, this machine is in operation and can kill anyone coming within range.
Shut off that machine.
The machine cannot be shut off until it reaches nadir. A sudden reversal would cause an explosion and take us all with it.
You there. Who are you?
Who, me? Just a friend of the family.
Arrest him.
Now, get your hands off me. Let go of me.
Now, Dr. Wensler, your son and his wife, where are they? Answer me, you old fool.
They
left a few minutes before you came.
Left? Jan, I told you to watch all the exits.
We did, Commander. Mouse could not have escaped. I swear it by the leader.
They are not here. You... What do you know of this?
I told you, they left some time ago.
Keep an eye on them. And keep away from that machine. Jan.
Yes, sir.
Send out a general alarm.
Yes, Commander.
Dr. Wensler, yes. Who are your son's friends?
Please. Commander, let me finish my experiment. I know nothing about my son's activities or his friends. I swear it. I know nothing about politics.
So?
I must stay here until this experiment is finished. It is too dangerous to be left unattended.
Very well. I'll take the American to headquarters. The rest of you, search the house.
Look here, I'm an American citizen. I demand...
Erickson!
Yes, my dear Wensler. Have you found him, Commander?
Erickson. You have betrayed me.
I am a member of the League of Loyal Scientists. Your son is the traitor, not I. Have you found him, Commander?
No. We have searched the house. Nothing. They swear the son and his wife escaped before we arrived.
That is ridiculous. They were here when I left. People do not vanish into thin air.
Then where are they?
Right under your nose, Commander.
What?
They're in the cylinder, of course, under the beam there. That is the only place they could be. Allow me to handle the controls. You shall have your prisoners in 5 minutes.
I see. Very clever, Dr. Wensler. Very clever. All right, Erickson. You take charge of the machine.
You spy, you traitor.
Don't let him touch that dial. Oh, grab him.
You won't. There.
He has set it for subatomic dimension.
What does that mean?
Whatever is in that cylinder has become as small as the atom.
Then shut it off.
It has almost reached nadir. We must wait 10 seconds, then reverse polarities. The machine has reached nadir. Angstrom 10 to the minus 11. We must now wait 10 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I don't know. Something must have gone wrong.
Alan, look up there.
Why, it's the solar system.
It's coming at us so fast. Look, the sun.
The sun? No, that can't be. Eva, that's the nucleus of an atom. We've reached the subatomic dimension. That sun is the nucleus, and those planets are the electrons revolving about it.
That planet coming up at us, there on the other side of the sun, the nucleus, is...
An electron. It's growing in size. They're heading straight for it.
They're coming down on it. They are going to land.
I guess we finally reached the nadir. We haven't shrunk for the past 2 or 3 hours.
Where are we?
I don't know. Somewhere in a valley between the mountains of a huge electronic ring.
It's almost funny, resting on the surface of an electron.
Look. The soil under the floor of the cylinder.
It looks like vegetation.
Yes. Moss. Like it. That's the last of the air. I've been expecting it to go out for the past 2 days. We have perhaps a half hour more. Eva, dearest.
I know.
There is one chance. That vegetation. That means there must be some sort of atmosphere on this electronic planet. We have to take that chance. Eva. Are you willing to step out of the cylinder with me?
Of course, my dearest. For whither thou goest, I will go. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, I will...
We haven't much time. Ready?
Ready. All right. Open the porthole.
Seven, eight, nine, ten. All right, 10 seconds. I shall now reverse polarity. I see something.
The cylinder?
Yes, here it is. Just a few seconds more and it will become normal size.
A foot high.
Keep that man quiet. Ah, it grows very rapidly.
Yes. 3 feet high. 4. Now. There you are, Commander. And in a moment, you will see your prisoners.
Get the door open.
Yes, sir. There is no door, my Commander.
No door? Erickson.
But there must be.
No, sir. Nothing but a gas valve.
You are right. Nothing but violet gas.
That's impossible.
Where are your son and his wife?
We told you they left the house some time ago.
That is a lie. Where are they?
I do not know.
Erickson. Open that valve.
But the gas may be poisonous.
We shall see. Open the valve. Very slightly. What is that?
I don't know. I seem to hear music inside my head.
So did I.
Apparently the gas produces auditory hallucinations.
Open the valve again. Careful.
We, the people of peace, greet the great scientist, the omnipotent, the maker of all.
I thought I heard a voice.
So
this
did I.
Is the law of our people, laid down by our first father 10 million years ago. But always and ever there be this record of our race. For it is told that thou, in the fruitfulness of time, shall take back unto thee this ark, like unto that cylinder in which the first father and mother of us all came unto us.
I don't understand.
I am the last of our race, and the sun is cold and desolation upon the face of our planet. But in our time there was majesty and joy and the gleaning of the fruits of the soil. For we have been the people of peace. And life was bountiful for generations until that day came when in thy everlasting wisdom thou didst decree the end of all. Though there were some who wept, we did not query why. For we have been a happy race. We have followed the law of the first father, Alan, and of the great mother, Eva.
No.
And we have builded this ark so that there may be report of our deeds and of the fulfillment of the trust. Now I, Lamarian, the last of the billions who lived here, do lie me down into that last sleep from which, if thou will, I shall awake unto the land which is thine. Hail, O great one, from the descendants of Alan and Eva, hail and farewell.
Good Lord, what was that?
And the Eva, Dr. Wensler, where are they?
They are beyond your reach.
What do you mean?
Don't you understand? All time is relative. 1 year of our time is one revolution of the planet Earth about the sun. Somewhere down in the microcosmos, my son and his wife found themselves in an atomic universe.
Of course.
And landed upon an electronic planet. That planet whirled around its sun, the nucleus of an atom, a million times in the space of a second. Our second.
Dr. Wensley, what are you trying to say?
That voice we heard is the voice of a human being, the last member of a race whose blood is mine. For in the space of 10 seconds of our time, Alan and Eva settled upon their microcosmic planet and bore sons and daughters, and a great and peaceful race that lived and died beyond infinity. And my children, Alan and Eva, who founded that race, are dead and gone. 10 million years ago. 10 seconds ago.
Tonight, Dimension X has presented Beyond Infinity, an original radio drama written by Vierre Gerson. Featured in the cast were Les Damon as Arnold, Lotta Stavitsky as Eva, E.A. Krumschmidt as Dr. Wensler, and Joe DeSantis as Alan Wensler. Your narrator was Norman Rose. Music by Albert Berman. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Edward King.
This program was transcribed. Stay tuned for Stories of the Underworld by Jack Late on NBC.
Okay, one last break here and then we'll be right back.
From Hollywood, Lorraine Tuttle in The Unexpected.
The Unexpected.
The Unexpected. Life is filled with the unexpected, romantic, tragic, and mysterious endings to our most ordinary actions. Dreams come true. Or dreams are shattered by sudden twists of fate in The Unexpected. And now, Lorraine Tuttle, outstanding radio and screen star in The Revere Cup, a drama of The Unexpected.
It was raining that afternoon, hard. My face was wet and my hair tumbled down into little moist strings that whipped the back of my neck. I ran across the street and scurried around the corner. I was looking for shelter, any kind of shelter. And then I saw it, the Trevor House, set far back behind the formal gardens, a huge brown mansion that seemed as dark and as wet as the gray sky above it. I don't think I recognized the place, not at first. And I remember shivering a little. But after a moment, I noticed something familiar about it. I had the feeling that I'd been there before. And I was right. I had. I'd lived in that mansion for 7 years. The first 7 years of my life. But that was a long time ago, when I was Janice Trevor. I don't really know why I started up the walk toward the forbidding entrance. The rain had almost stopped, and I could have gone on home. I was soaked to the skin already. A few minutes more wouldn't have made any difference. But I was standing on the porch, and I did lift the heavy brass knocker. And I heard the thud echoing back as it struck the oak panel.
Yes, miss?
I wonder if I could come inside for a moment, just to dry off.
I suppose it would be all right. Are you a friend of the Stevensons?
No, I've never met them. I just happened to see the house and
Oh, of course. Come inside, miss. There's a fire in the drawing room.
Thank you.
It's through that archway and to your right.
I'll only stay a moment.
Certainly, miss. Could I get you anything?
Well, yes, if you would. Some tea or anything. You're really very kind to a stranger.
Not at all, miss. For some reason, you don't seem like a stranger to Trevor Mansion. You just don't seem like a stranger.
The room hadn't changed. Not really. There were brighter curtains at the windows and new slipcovers on the chairs. And somehow it seemed a little smaller. But then I was larger than I'd been when I last sat before this fire 18 years ago. And listened to a dull lawyer's voice read the will that left me only the debts of Malcolm Trevor. Only the sorrows of my multimillionaire father, whose paper empire had become mere paper. I hadn't listened to the words that told of auctions and receiverships and guardians, because I was seeing my father's face burned by the powder of the gun he'd held to his temple.
You play chess?
Oh, I beg your pardon?
I asked if you played chess.
Well, no. That is, not very well.
Well, neither do I, but it seemed like a good opening. I'm Tom Stevenson. I live here.
Yes, I know.
Do you?
Do I what?
Live here. The place is so big, one can never be sure.
No, I just dropped in to get out of the rain.
Well, under those circumstances, allow me to extend an official welcome, Miss
Miss Martin. Janice Martin.
It's funny. I'm sure we should have met before. Are you a friend of the family's? They're in Florida now, you know.
No, I just came in to get out of the rain. Your butler was kind enough to let me dry out here by your fire.
Ah, good old Wilson. He's an incurable romantic. Been trying to get me married off for years. Keeps throwing all sorts of women at me.
All sorts?
Oh, come now, I didn't mean it that way. On the whole, you're far better than the average.
Well, thank you.
Well, come on, I'll show you around the house. It's quite fantastic. Once you've seen it, you'll never want to come back, but at least your afternoon won't have been wasted.
It is rather an extraordinary place. Did you build it?
Oh, good heavens, no. Some millionaire named Trevor put it up. Only he really wasn't a millionaire.
No?
No, at least he wasn't when the market crashed. He blew his brains out, and my father bought the place just as it stood, lock, stock, and barrel. It was quite cheap, considering. And it's full of the weirdest stuff. Most of it's not worth anything. Here, look at these cases here.
Huh?
All full of junk that old man Trevor brought back from Africa, India, everywhere.
Well, why do you keep it here?
It's good for laughs.
Laughs?
Yes. As a matter of fact, most of it's very funny. Take that miniature loving cup. I wonder what high school order won that.
He was quite right. The case was full of an amazing collection of worthless odds and ends. Except about the loving cup, he was quite wrong. I could remember my mother saying to me, Janice, dear, you mustn't play with that cup. It's worth more than this whole house. You see, Janice, it was made by Paul Revere. I'd been surprised. Then Mother told me that Revere had been the greatest American silversmith, that his work was considered almost priceless. And I knew that if I could only get that cup away from Tom Stevenson and his family, I'd be rich again. They didn't realize its value, thought of it as junk. I'd be able to buy it easily. And if I couldn't, well, I'd find another way to get the Revere cup. You're right, Tom. Oh, this is a frightful amount of junk.
Well, come along. There's lots more to see.
Oh, thank you, but I really must leave now.
All right, if you say so.
You don't seem brokenhearted.
I'm not.
Well, you're honest and frank.
Sure. When can I see you again?
What?
Well, I can't let the butler down. He'd be terribly disappointed if we didn't hit it off. He's introduced me to so many strange young ladies that he's beginning to lose hope. Mustn't let Wilson lose hope. Have to see you again.
Oh, really, Mr. Stevenson?
I'll take you home or out to dinner or to a show. I don't know which, but I'll decide. Okay, Janice?
Well, I don't
know. You'll have to change your dress and fix your hair, though. You look terrible now.
Really? You're the most unusual man I've ever met.
It's an unusual house. It needs unusual people.
It seems so. Oh, Tom.
Hmm?
That reminds me.
Yeah?
That little silver cup you showed me. Could I buy it from you?
Certainly not.
Why?
This may look like a junk store, but I'm not a salesman.
Well, I thought you didn't like
it. Why, Janice, that cup always gets a good laugh when I show it. I wouldn't think of losing the subject of a good laugh. I need it to start conversation. Wouldn't part with that cup for any amount. No, sir. I'll give you my right arm if you want it, but I can't break up this wonderful collection of junk. What would I have to talk about?
You couldn't be serious around Tom. It's just as well. I'd spend as much time with him as possible. And sooner or later, I'd get my hands on that cup. I saw him almost every night that week. But no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get my hands on that priceless cup. And then suddenly he stopped calling. I didn't hear from him for 2 weeks. I was sure he'd realized I was after the cup. Then one night I found him sitting on the steps of my apartment house.
Where have you been?
Well, where have you been?
Here, waiting for you.
I mean, for the last 2 weeks.
Oh, well, I've been around thinking things over.
What sort of things?
Marriage. You think I should marry you? Wilson does.
Oh, really, Tom? Sometimes you aren't very funny.
I know, but I can't help that. Well, come along.
Where are we going?
To the mansion. Wilson's fixed a dinner to celebrate.
To celebrate?
Yes. Our engagement. I have decided to marry you, Janice.
And what if I...
Oh, now, see here. You can't let Wilson down. He's got the candles all lit, the champagne cooled, and... Well, you'll have to marry me. He'd be terribly hurt if you didn't.
Table for two had been laid out in the living room, white cover and silver dishes. Tom excused himself to make some final arrangements with Wilson, and I sat in one of the big chairs to wait for him. Believe me, I had no intention of marrying him. All I wanted from Tom Stevenson was the Revere cup. But suddenly I jumped up. The door to the glass-fronted cabinet was open, and there was an empty spot among the bric-a-brac. The cup was gone. My heart headed toward my feet, and I felt a little ill. I'd counted on it so much, and now it slipped past me. I turned and sat down again, and as I did, my arm brushed something off a small end table. The shadowy candlelight glinted on tarnished silver. I reached down to pick it up. It was the Revere cup. This was my chance. All I had to do was stuff the cup into my purse and walk out the door. I looked carefully around the room and out into the hall. There was no one in sight. I grabbed the cup, slipped it into my handbag, and headed toward home. And inside my head, I was singing. I had the Revere cup, the original, authentic Paul Revere masterpiece. For the first time in 18 years, I was going to know what it was like to have money. Now I could live like Janice Trevor again.
You think the story is over, don't you? But wait. Fate takes a hand. Wait for the unexpected.
I could hear the cup tinkling against the compact in my pocketbook as I strolled casually toward the front door. In just a moment, I'd be outside. Tom might miss the cup and even suspect that I'd taken it, but he wouldn't do anything about that. He'd say it was just junk and spend a few minutes wondering why I'd walked out on his engagement party. And then he'd forget about me. That's the way Tom was. At least, that's what I thought.
Janice, you'd better give me back that cup.
Why, I don't know what you're talking about.
Makes your purse all bulgy. It's really very easy to detect.
But, Tom, let me explain.
Oh, don't bother. Just give it back.
Well,
I wouldn't like to have to call the police, Janice.
Oh, very well. Here, take it, and I hope
Janice. You know, I can't understand what you see in this cup. I never could. Since you wanted it so much, I was planning to give it to you as a sort of an engagement present. But under the circumstances, it would never do for me to be married to a thief, would it?
The Revere Cup starred Lorene Tuttle. Listen soon for another of your favorite motion picture stars in a drama of the unexpected. This program was transcribed in Hollywood.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. The Altar at Midnight by C.M. Kornbluth. Read by Mark Nelson. He had quite a rum blossom on him for a kid, I thought at first. But when he moved closer to the light by the cash register to ask the bartender for a match or something, I saw it wasn't that. Not just the nose. Broken veins on his cheeks, too, and the funny eyes. He must have seen me look, because he slid back away from the light. The bartender shook my bottle of ale in front of me like a Swiss bell ringer, so it foamed inside the green glass. "You ready for another, sir?" he asked. I shook my head. Down the bar, he tried it on the kid. He was drinking scotch and water or something like that, and found out he could just push him around. He sold him 3 scotch and waters in 10 minutes. When he tried for number 4, the kid had his courage up and said, "I'll tell you when I'm ready for another, Jack." But there wasn't any trouble. It was almost 9, and the place began to fill up. The manager, a real hood type, stationed himself by the door to screen out the high school kids and give the big hello to conventioneers. The girls came hurrying in, too, with their little makeup cases and their fancy hair piled up and their frozen faces with the perfect mouths drawn on them. One of them stopped to say something to the manager, some excuse about something, and he said, "That's all right. Get in a dressing room." A three-piece band behind the drapes at the back of the stage began to make warm-up noises, and there were two bartenders keeping busy. Mostly it was beer, a midweek crowd. I finished my ale and had to wait a couple of minutes before I could get another bottle. The bar filled up from the end near the stage because all the customers wanted a good, close look at the strippers for their 50-cent bottles of beer. But I noticed that nobody sat down next to the kid. Or if anybody did, he didn't stay long. You go out for some fun, and the bartender pushes you around, and nobody wants to sit next to you. I picked up my bottle and glass and went down on the stool to his left. He turned to me right away and said, "What kind of a place is this, anyway?" The broken veins were all over his face, the little ones, but so many, so close, that they made his face look something like marbled rubber. The funny look in his eyes was it, the trick contact lenses. But I tried not to stare and not to look away. "It's okay," I said. "It's a good show, if you don't mind a lot of noise from..." He stuck a cigarette into his mouth and poked the pack at me. "I'm a spacer," he said, interrupting. I took one of his cigarettes and said, "Oh." He snapped a lighter for the cigarettes and said, "Venus." I was noticing that his pack of cigarettes on the bar had some kind of yellow sticker instead of the blue tax stamp. "Ain't that a crock?" he asked. "You can't smoke, and they give you lighters for a souvenir. But it's a good lighter. On Mars last week, they gave us all some cheap pen and pencil sets." "You get something every trip, huh?" I took a good long drink of ale, and he finished his scotch and water. "Shoot. You call a trip a shoot." One of the girls was working her way down the bar. She was going to slide onto the empty stool at his right and give him the business, but she looked at him first and decided not to. She curled around me and asked if I'd buy her a little old drink. I said no, and she moved on to the next. I could kind of feel the young fellow quivering. When I looked at him, he stood up. I followed him out of the dump. The manager grinned without thinking and said, "Good night, boys," to us. The kid stopped in the street and said to me, "You don't have to follow me around, Pappy." He sounded like one wrong word, and I would get socked in the teeth. "Take it easy. I know a place where they won't spit in your eye." He pulled himself together and made a joke of it. "This I have to see," he said. "Near here?" "A few blocks." We started walking. It was a nice night. "I don't know this city at all," he said. "I'm from Covington, Kentucky. You do your drinking at home there. We don't have places like this." He meant the whole Skid Row area. "It's not so bad," I said. "I spend a lot of time here." "Is that a fact? I mean, down home, a man your age would likely have a wife and children." "I do. The hell with them." He laughed like a real youngster, and I figured he couldn't even be 25. He didn't have any trouble with the broken curbstones, in spite of his scotch and waters. I asked him about it. "Sense of balance," he said. "You have to be tops for balance to be a spacer. You spend so much time outside in a suit. People don't know how much. Punctures, and you aren't worth a damn if you lose your point."
"What's that mean?"
"Oh, well, it's hard to describe. When you're outside and you lose your point, it means you're all mixed up. You don't know which way the can, that's the ship, which way the can is. It's having all that room around you. But if you have a good balance, you feel a little tugging to the ship. Or maybe you just know which way the ship is without feeling it. Then you have your point, and you can get the work done."
"There must be a lot of that that's hard to describe."
He thought that might be a crack, and he clammed up on me. "You call this Gandy Town," I said after a while. "It's where the stove-up old railroad men hang out. This is the place." It was the second week of the month, before everybody's pension check was all gone. Oswiak's was jumping. The grandsons of the pioneers were on the juke, singing the Man from Mars yodel, and old Paddy Shea was jigging in the middle of the floor. He had a full sidle of beer in his right hand, and his empty left sleeve was flapping. The kid balked at the screen door. "Too damn bright," he said. I shrugged and went on in, and he followed. We sat down at a table. At Oswiak's, you can drink at the bar if you want to, but none of the regulars do. Patty jigged over and said, "Welcome home, Doc." He's a Liverpool Irishman. They talk like Scots, some say, but they sound almost like Brooklyn to me. "Hello, Patty. I brought somebody uglier than you. Now what do you say?" Patty jigged around the kid in a half circle, with his sleeve flapping, and then flopped into a chair when the record stopped. He took a big drink from the sidle and said, "Can he do this?" Patty stretched his face into an awful grin that showed his teeth. "He has three of them." The kid laughed and asked me, "What the hell do you drag me into here for?" "Patty says he'll buy drinks for the house the day anybody uglier than he is comes in." Oswiak's wife waddled over for the order, and the kid asked us what we'd have. I figured I could start drinking, so it was three double scotches. After the second round, Patty started blowing about how they took his arm off without any anesthetics except a bottle of gin, because the red ball freight he was tangled up in couldn't wait. That brought some of the other old gimps over to the table with their stories. Blackie Bauer had been sitting in a boxcar with his legs sticking through the door when the train started with a jerk. Wham! The door closed. Everybody laughed at Blackie for being that dumb in the first place, and he got mad. Sam Fireman has palsy. This week he was claiming he used to be a watchmaker before he began to shake. The week before, he said he was a brain surgeon. A woman I didn't know, a real old boxcar Bertha, dragged herself over and began some kind of story about how her sister married a Greek, but she passed out before we found out what happened. Somebody wanted to know what was wrong with the kid's face, Bauer, I think it was, after he came back to the table. "Compression and decompression," the kid said. "You're all the time climbing into your suit and out of your suit. Inboard air's thin to start with. You get a few red lines, that's these ruptured blood vessels, and then you say, 'The hell with the money. All you'll make is just one more trip.' But, God, it's a lot of money for anybody my age. You keep saying that until you can't be anything but a spacer. The eyes are hard radiation scars." "You like that all over?" asked Oswiak's wife politely. "All over, ma'am," the kid told her in a miserable voice. "But I'm going to quit before I get a Bowman head." "I don't care," said Maggie Rorty. "I think he's cute." "Compared with," Patty began, but I kicked him under the table. We sang for a while, then we told gags and recited limericks for a while, and I noticed that the kid and Maggie had wandered into the back room, the one with the latch on the door. Oswiak's wife asked me, very puzzled, "Doc, why they do that flying by the planets?" "It's the damn government," Sam Fireman said. "Why not?" I said. "They got the Bowman drive. Why the hell shouldn't they use it? Serves 'em right." I had a double scotch and added, 20 years of it, and they found out a few things they didn't know. Red lines are only one of them. 20 years more, maybe they'll find out a few more things they didn't know. Maybe by the time there's a bathtub in every American home and an alcoholism clinic in every American town, they'll find out a whole lot of things they didn't know. And every American boy will be a pop-eyed, blood-rattled wreck like our friend here from riding the Bowman drive. "It's the damn government," Sam Fireman repeated. "And what the hell did you mean by that remark about alcoholism?" Patty said, real sore. "Personally, I can take it or leave it alone." So we got to talking about that, and everybody there turned out to be people who could take it or leave it alone. It was maybe midnight when the kid showed at the table again, looking kind of dazed. I was drunker than I ought to be by midnight, so I said I was going for a walk. He tagged along, and we wound up on a bench at Screwball Square. The soapboxers were still going strong. Like I said, it was a nice night. After a while, a pot-bellied old auntie, who didn't give a damn about the face, sat down and tried to talk the kid into going to see some etchings. The kid didn't get it, and I led him over to hear the soapboxers before there was trouble. One of the orators was a mush-mouthed evangelist.
"And oh, my friends," he said, "when I looked through the porthole of the spaceship and beheld the wonder of the firmament."
"You're a stinking Yankee liar," the kid yelled at him. "You say one damn more word about can shooting, and I'll ram your spaceship down your lying throat. Where's your red lines if you're such a hot spacer?"
The crowd didn't know what he was talking about, but "where's your red lines" sounded good to them, so they heckled Mushmouth off his box with it. I got the kid to a bench. The liquor was working in him all of a sudden. He simmered down after a while and asked, "Doc, should I have given Miss Rorty some money? I asked her afterward, and she said she'd admire to have something to remember me by, so I gave her my lighter. She seemed to be real pleased with it, but I was wondering if maybe I embarrassed her by asking her right out. Like I told you, back in Covington, Kentucky, we don't have places like that. Or maybe we did, and I just didn't know about them. But what do you think I should have done about Miss Rorty?"
"Just what you did," I told him. "If they want money, they ask you for it first. Where are you staying?"
"YMCA," he said, almost asleep. "Back in Covington, Kentucky, I was a member of the Y, and I kept up my membership. They have to let me in because I'm a member. Spaces have all kinds of trouble, Doc. Women trouble, hotel trouble, family trouble, religious trouble. I was raised a Southern Baptist, but where's heaven anyway? I asked Dr. Shitwood last time home before the red lines got so thick. Doc, you aren't a minister of the gospel, are you? I hope I didn't say anything to offend you."
"No offense, son," I said. "No offense." I walked him to the avenue and waited for a fleet cab. It was almost 5 minutes. The independents that roll drunks dent the fenders of fleet cabs if they show up in Skid Row, and then the fleet drivers have to make reports on their own time to the company. It keeps them away. But I got one and dumped the kid in. "The Y Hotel," I told the driver. "Here's five. Help him in when you get there." When I walked through Screwball Square again, some college kids were yelling, "Where's your red lines?" at old Charlie, the last of the Wobblies. Old Charlie kept roaring, "The hell with your bread lines! I'm talking about atomic bombs! Right up there!" And he pointed at the moon. It was a nice night, but the liquor was dying in me. There was a joint around the corner, so I went in, had a drink to carry me to the club. I had a bottle there. I got into the first cab that came. "Athletic Club," I said. "In a doghouse, huh?" the driver said, and he gave me a big personality smile. I didn't say anything, and he started the car. He was right, of course. I was in everybody's doghouse. Someday, I'd scare the hell out of Tom and Lisa by going home and showing them what their daddy looked like. Down at the Institute, I was in the doghouse. "Oh, dear," everybody at the Institute said to everybody. "I'm sure I don't know what ails the man. A lovely wife and two lovely grown children, and she had to tell him, 'Either you go or I go.' And drinking. And this is rather subtle, but it's a well-known fact that neurotics seek out low company to compensate for their guilt feelings. The places he frequents. Dr. Francis Bowman, the man who made space flight a reality. The man who put the bomb base on the moon. Really, I'm sure I don't know what ails him." The hell with them all. The end of The Altar at Midnight by C.M. Kornbluth.
Well, folks, that's all. I did, before I leave, want to recommend to you my website, nighttransmissions.com. You see, I usually have a fair amount of ancillary material on the website. It's on the website where I go into a bit more detail about the shows and the individual episodes, sometimes the writers and actors. For example, if you like that Cyril Kornbluth story, I have several more links at the website. at least one link to the reading of another short story, and a link to the Gutenberg text file of another Cyril Hornbluth story. This one from 1950, this one called The Black Bag. Other than that, I got little to say right now, except this is Gary Clinton. See ya.